Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Save the Kids podcast. It's your one-stop shop for raising kids in this tech-heavy world. We bring on professionals and experts to give you all the tools you need to help your kids become fire-breathing warriors that have the strength to break out of the mold society has put them in. At the end of the day, we're all here for one reason, to help save some kids. I'm your host, Nate Webb. Let's get to it. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Save the Kids podcast. It's your host, Nate Webb, live in Studio Salt Lake City area, and we have a show for you today. As all of you know, we are big advocates against child sexual abuse here at Save the Kids. That's one of the things that we fight against biggest here at Save the Kids, and there's so much that we as parents are ignorant to, especially in this online world. Some of it is starting to come to the forefront with things coming to the mainstream media like Sound of Freedom and things like that. But there's still so much that we are ignorant to and so much that I think that we as parents are scared to know about. So I reached out and found an expert on the matter to help educate us. Rosalia Rivera is a consent educator and a child sexual abuse prevention specialist. She's a sexual literacy advocate, a 2-time TEDx speaker, rape culture disruptor, chair of SAGE, Survivor Advocates Globally Empowered, and representing the Brave Movement, co-founder of the Survivors Council of Canada, and the founder of Consent Parenting, the host of About Consent podcast, and the creator of Consent Wear. Welcome to the show, dude. Thanks for taking time to be on the show.
Thank you. That was a mouthful of an intro.
I know.
Thank you.
thanks
for inviting me.
Absolutely. I saw a lot of your stuff and I was like, oh my goodness, we need to talk to her. Because there's just so much in this world that parents are unaware of and so much preventable stuff that that like we don't have to be scared of the world. We just need just little preventable things. So first off, how did you get into this space? Tell us your story there. How you got here, you know, consent parenting and all this stuff you've been doing. How did you get to this space?
Yeah, so I actually did so because I'm a mom. I have 3 kids, and my oldest, when he was 5, I wanted to put him in a summer day camp. And when I was about to bring him in that first day, and even the day before, I started having sort of like anxiety building up. Wasn't really even sure why. It was like, you know, parents take their kids to, you know, day camps all the time. Like, right. Shouldn't be anything I'm feeling anxious about. And then the day I dropped him off, I was like, oh my God, like, I don't know all these people. There were so many volunteers and, you know, youth counselors and stuff. And I just started to panic. And I realized I didn't do anything to prepare to educate my child to, you know, and then on top of it, a lot of stuff started coming to light for me in terms of memories of my own history. It was what really changed everything and made me realize I need to make sure I'm breaking the cycle and that what happened to me isn't going to happen to my child, and started really educating myself about the issue at large in terms of how to protect my kids and what do I teach them. And as I was educating myself, I realized, oh my God, this problem is way bigger than I had even known, and I think most people know, and it's really challenging as a survivor especially. So I decided I was going to dedicate myself to healing and to figuring out how to make sure that I can teach this stuff, because as I was learning it, it was really triggering. Mm-hmm. And I eventually realized, like, not many people are speaking to the survivor experience as a parent. Mm. And I started implementing and teaching my child, saw that it was really actually an empowering experience when you know how to approach it in the right way. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to then be able to provide that to other parents who were also survivors, and just to be able to speak openly about the experience to help others, because I wasn't seeing that being talked about enough. And just to, you know, again, try to come at it from a place of empowerment and not fear.
Right, right. Because a lot of people come from the place of fear, right? And that's where we make, unfortunately, a lot of decisions. Now, you mentioned that you're also a survivor, and obviously we don't want to get into too many details there, but was it something like a youth summer camp as well, where you had abuse and stuff like that?
No, it's actually unfortunately, it was in intrafamilial, so it was my father, and I just had a lot of suppressed memories, and I knew that it was true once I came to terms with it because my sister's also a survivor, and she had come out when she was 20 about it. So I was
Wow.
much younger at the time, but I believed her. I remember her telling me when she was younger, and it was just like there was no doubt of like, oh, I can't believe our father would do that. It was like, oh, of course, And then when it came to me realizing my own memories, it all kind of it all made sense, and it all fit because of, oh, I was always afraid of my dad for weird reasons, which I didn't know at the time. When my parents were divorced, I was ecstatic, which I think most kids would be like, oh no, my
Right. They're
parents are
sad.
breaking
They
up.
split.
And yeah, and like I want to see my dad. And I was just happy. Like it was like, oh, thank goodness. I mean, there were a lot of other issues within their relationship, which I was glad to see was over. But yeah, when you start to kind of put the pieces together, backwards, it's like, oh, it just all the pieces fit and it makes sense now.
Well, and kind of piggybacking off that, most of the time when people think of predators and child abuse, they think of some creepy stranger in their parents' basement on their computer. But statistically, that's just not the case, is it? It's usually someone they know, isn't it?
90%. 90%.
90%.
So,
Wow.
yeah, 90% is people that you know and trust. The way that that breaks down is kind of crazy. Like 30% is family, could be family. A larger percentage of it nowadays is peer to peer. So even in a summer camp, it could be, a
A
peer, but
participant.
it could also
Wow.
be, it could also be a peer in school. It could be someone that is a cousin. It could even be a sibling. I think there's still a lot of research that needs to be done because, there is such a misconception that it's really only ever adults. So we really do need to be aware of that. Those numbers have been rising over the years, and particularly because of online exposure to adult content or to being exposed by an offender who's trying to get kids to view content that's not for them or to extort them. We know all those different ways that that's happening too, but then that behavior gets mimicked or passed on to another child. So there's and these are, people that children know, right? So there's where the 90% comes from. And aside from,
Holy
teachers or coaches
smokes.
or, clergy, it's always someone that you know. Really only 10% happens by strangers.
10% only happens by strangers, 90% people that you know. You know, what really struck me as you were talking about, like, that it's not just adults. It's quite often it can also be peer-to-peer children, right? And I wonder, how do they get in that spot? And it, to my head, it's usually just like the cycle, right? People who were formerly abused tend to get into the cycle of abuse. And you mentioned some other things there too, like pornography exposure and whatnot. In your experience, what kind of leads a kid to become an offender versus or from victim to abuser, or what have you seen?
Yeah, so there's a few different pathways to that. So for starters, a lot of times it's not necessarily abuse, it's just considered sexually harmful behavior. And what I mean by that is it could be children that are experimenting in age appropriate ways, but then there's no intervention that happens and it escalates. So it can become harmful at that point and it can be introduced to other children and it can grow in that way. So it's important to have that intervention happen, to teach body boundaries and body safety so that it doesn't escalate. A second way is that it could be a older child who is has knowledge ha you know of sexual activity, either from seeing something like adult content or having that experience from another peer or another adult that has introduced it to them, and then they will coerce or force a younger child or a weaker child, maybe a developmentally,
Behind.
developmentally different. Yeah. So there's that factor. Others can be siblings. Again, similar, either experimentation or because of, you know, I've even heard a story of a situation where a 16-year-old brother was online playing a game, got tricked by an offender into, you know, the sort of traditional sextortion kind of situation where, you know, they pretend to be someone else, get the child to send a nude, and then they're now on a cycle of extortion. And in this particular case, the offender forced him to offend on the sibling and to record it. And otherwise, you know, the threat was, you know, I'm going to burn your house down, I'm going to kill your parents, like all these horrendous things that you know, he knew his address, which is what made it so real, because he had found out like where he lived. And so this child was terrified, thought that this would, you know, suffice to
have to do this horrible thing in order to save my whole family. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And then fortunately, Homeland Security was on to this guy. They eventually arrested him and were able to stop the situation, but so much damage was done. And this, you know, is a situation which most people would never imagine could happen. And it happens way more often than people think. So situations like that, you know, can be an issue. It can happen at school, it can happen at home, it can happen by a babysitter who's older. So there's a lot of different ways that peer-to-peer can be an issue.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Now you've mentioned several times now, like the online factor, that mm-hmm. things can happen there. How has that influenced the realm of child sexual abuse?
It has been one of the biggest factors for the sharp rise. I do have to say COVID was definitely a big issue because kids were home, they had to be online, and parents were still working, so they couldn't monitor their kids as much. A lot of people just didn't have the education to like know how to teach their kids body safety, or they were given devices at school to do distance learning, and then the devices didn't have, you know, either monitoring apps or filters to, you know, prevent, you know,
measures put in place to keep them safe.
Yeah. So that kind of exploded everything onto the scene of like what we're seeing now. So CSAM, which is child sexual abuse material.
Right.
Yeah. That has skyrocketed because there was this sort of increasing demand for that kind of content. So it's just been really, I would say one of the biggest factors was COVID that made the situation worse, and kids just being online more and more, you know, for various reasons. I think schools continued to, you know, continued the digital access process.
The devices,
the
convenience.
Still,
yeah.
Yeah. And parents, again, just not really knowing. It's such an overwhelming world to step into if you're not familiar with it. And, you know, whether it's online gaming and having offenders reach out to kids, you know, tricking them into whatever it is that that particular situation turns into, and not the child not having the education or the information to know what to do in a situation like that. So they get trapped in it. It escalates into worse things. And, you know, the scary thing is that although we're seeing these rises and these spikes, part of it is because there has been more awareness of reporting, which is fantastic. But the other aspect is that there's still a lot of cases that are not being reported. That we're not hearing about until many, many years later when the abuse has stopped.
Oh, man. That's so scary, because everyone's worst fear is something like that happening to their kid. We're having similar feelings. Our oldest is headed off into kindergarten, all day kindergarten. And you know, you hear the horror stories about stuff happening at school, stuff happening. And you're just like, I don't want that to happen to our kids. And we all want to empower and protect our kids against sexual abuse and against sexual predators. And there's a thought pattern amongst parents, especially Christian parents, that if we teach our kids about sex early on, that we're robbing them of their innocence. If we teach them about inappropriate touching and all these things early on, that we're robbing them of their innocence. And it simply isn't true. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that age appropriate education is important. And I think for a lot of people, when they hear that we have to talk about prevention, they think it opens Pandora's box to talking about all of it at once. And it's really a gradual conversation. You know, we have to teach in a way that's developmentally appropriate, which means what the child can actually understand and the concepts that they need to know. So what do they need when they're 2 versus 8? What do they need when they're 8 versus 12? So we want to teach in age-appropriate ways, but we also want to be matter of fact. We want to be evidence-informed. We want to be shame-free.
Unemotional. So,
yeah, I think we get very wrapped up in our own sense of what is sex and like, what are the values that we want to teach and how can we, like, is it still something that you believe that maybe you were taught when you were younger that actually doesn't really align with your values today? So I think
our own
part
traumas
of it is,
associated with the different words, like how many of you parents get super uncomfortable if I say the word penis, right? And not your ding-a-ling, not your doodah. Like, kids aren't emotional about that. It's a body part. We're the ones that have emotion tied to it. And we sometimes often project that onto our kids, I feel like.
Oh, big time. I think people still consider a lot of those words dirty words. And they're not.
Nope.
You know, I think that adds so much shame to, you know, these parts that are absolutely normal, functional, important, necessary body parts that, you know, everybody has and in some way, shape or form, and that there's nothing evil about them, right? Nope. So I think, again, just reexamining what are the values that we have around these things? Why is it that we're uncomfortable, and kind of digging into that a little bit to dismantle old ways of thinking that actually don't serve anyone really, other than offenders. Offenders are the ones that are happy that parents have these perceptions, because then they can keep their child naive and innocent in the wrong way, you know, innocent in a way that actually can harm the child more than if they were given facts and the truth.
Yeah. Oh, that is so big. And something that you mentioned that is super important is developmentally appropriate education. And how do we discern what's correct and what is appropriate to teach someone who's 5 headed into kindergarten versus someone who's 15 headed into high school?
Yeah, so there are different standards depending, I think, on the country you live. But I think for the most part, like if you look at World Health Organization, there are some standards of what children do need to know at certain points, particularly as it relates to abuse prevention and body safety education. We don't have to get into the nitty gritty when a child is really young. You don't have to explain the, you know, mechanics of sex and sexuality, but, you know, this is a time when children are naturally curious about bodies, about, you know, how babies are made and, you know, these very basic things that I think most parents are even afraid of, like, how do I introduce this? Cause it wasn't introduced to them, but it's really just about helping a child understand themselves. So I think if we, rephrase it to say, well, what we're actually teaching when a child is really young is body literacy, which helps with body safety.
Right.
That's the foundation that we want to start at. And then we build from there. So we don't want to think about it as like when they get to, you know, maybe puberty, we're going to have the talk. That's very late. You know,
the
you want to start
it's not just one talk, guys.
It's not just one. It's a series. And we want to have, you know, we especially today, we want to be that safe resource for our kids, because if we aren't, they're going to seek out that information elsewhere.
Oh,
because unfortunately,
you or Google, you choose.
Yeah, you or Google. That's right. I think that's really the best way to say it. It's like the information is out there. And it's not always the safest information. And so having these conversations early and ongoing is going to help your child be safer. And really, that's the bottom line. If you aren't the source, someone else will be. And they will not give your child the accurate information that they actually need.
Yeah. Education puts power into, you know, puts power in our kids' hands. And we are the forefront. It is our job as parents to give that power to our kids, to help protect our kids. However, it's not all on them and it's not all on us. In a lot of your content, you talk about this 50-50 rule when it comes to child mm-hmm. sexual abuse prevention. Tell us a little bit about that.
So we tended to, I think in the 80s and 90s, there was this push to educate kids about body safety and how to say no, run, yell, and tell, right? And I think there is some validity to that, but it's also putting all of the onus on our kids to protect themselves in order to prevent abuse. And mm-hmm. what research has shown is that actually what is even more effective beyond just teaching kids is also to create preventative communities, which means adults talking, asking questions, being open about the fact that this is something that you're teaching in your home. Body safety is a priority in your home. And so if you can talk to family members and community leaders and, you know, caregivers that are going to be with your child and let them know we're teaching body safety in our home, these are the body safety practices that we have. This is, you know, this is how we would love for you to help participate in that. Or when you're going to put your child in a school, asking them questions and saying, you know, what are the body safety practices or the abuse prevention policies that you have in place? Are you teaching body safety as part of your curriculum? And really getting more involved and making sure that the school is being accountable and that they are being responsible with their duty to protect children instead of just assuming that they're doing that. And assuming that the church, you know, that the youth pastor has gone through background checks. And, you know, so really doing due diligence to make yeah. sure that the people who are in charge, who are caring for kids, who are tasked with protecting them are actually doing that job. And having these conversations, being open about it, normalizing this topic and not mm-hmm. shying away from it and assuming that, you know, everyone's doing their job, because as we can see time after time, organization after organization, they're not, because no one is holding them to account. So part of this 50-50 is being that advocate for your child, being their first advocate, showing them how to use their voice, how to ask questions, how to set boundaries with adults as well, right? So not just telling Johnny, you know, if grandma wants a hug and, you know, you don't have to hug her, but if grandma pushes for that hug, being that parent who steps in and shows how to set that firm boundary or how to, you know, uphold it if it's being crossed, yeah. Modeling that for your child and being that advocate that, you know, helps explain to grandma, like, here's the reasons why we're doing it and why we need you to respect it. And if you're not going to respect it, here's the additional boundaries that are going to be set in place. So, you know, really taking that next step to be vocal and an advocate, not just teaching your child how to be their own advocate.
I love that. I love that. It's great to teach your kid to be an advocate, but you also need to advocate for your kids. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things when it comes to child sexual abuse that you found that most parents are just simply unaware of?
I think that they're unaware of how often it happens. And the statistics are different depending on your part of the world. Like Bolivia is like 1 in 3. India is 1 in 2. The US is 1 in 4.
Whoa, so 1 in 2? Half.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And then US not much better. 1/5. So 1 in 5. Holy.
One in four.
1 in 4 for the US. So
one
a quarter.
For the US.
A quarter.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And again, these are numbers that are conservative. Most experts believe that they're much higher. Yeah. And you know, when you look around and you talk to people, you realize, like, I know more than, you know, if I was to look at 4 of my friends, there's probably 2 or 3, even maybe all of us, who, you know, have had some experience at some point. And I think when we calculate you know, what it means to be 18 and under, right? Like,
right.
So here's a crazy statistic that most people don't know, and I think this is really alarming to parents. 70% of all rape cases in the United mm-hmm. States are reported by minors.
Wow. 70% of all rape cases in the United States are reported by minors. And yeah. there's And there's also the scary statistics that a very, very small amount of rape cases are even reported. So 70% of those very small things, like the very small number that even gets reported, is mostly by minors.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So that's one that, I mean, I think the 90% is crazy, you know, to start with, that 90% are people that you know, because I think that misconception still is out there today that it's only strangers. But I'll give you a better statistic.
Yay.
90% of abuse can be prevented through education.
Oh, look at that, guys. It is so preventable. So preventable. That's I think that is what a lot of people miss. Where when advocates are talking about this stuff, they hear, you know, fire and brimstone, and they get freaked out. And it's like, no, guys, this is preventable. We are here not to scare, but to help you prepare. So I guess, what are some of the practical things that parents can do now to help protect their kids? Now that we freaked all you guys out, okay, it's okay. what top three things, what can we do to help protect our kids?
Yeah. And I just want to say, like, I hate having to be the bearer of bad news. So I always like to, you know, just remind parents, like, it's not all doom and gloom. It really isn't. There is so much that we have power to do, that we can change. This is why I'm like out here sometimes looking like a crazy person yelling, you know, just there's so much we can do. And it's not always, you know, easy, but it's actually simple, you know, and it really is just about educating yourself, learning how to talk to your kids about these topics, and then learning how to talk to others about these topics, right? So right now, my big push is we're about to start school. Here's what you can know to talk to the people at your school and ask them the right questions and make sure that they're doing the right things. So, you know, education, 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 like all the way. And practicing it, like, don't just learn it, but actually start implementing it. Little baby steps make a big difference. You know, you don't have to do everything overnight. You don't have to teach everything tomorrow, but you do have to get started. And the simplest way for me that I think is really empowering for parents and kids is to start talking about consent, to start teaching kids about body autonomy, about boundaries. You know, there's three different components to boundaries, which most people don't realize. It's like, first of all, understanding what boundaries are, then figuring out what your boundaries are, and then learning how to implement those boundaries and uphold them, right? So there's three pieces that kids need to learn, and that takes time, and that alone can make a big difference, right? And from there, you can teach kids what consent means and how to ask for consent, how to give consent or not give consent. And then we can start actually going into the abuse prevention pieces, which, you know, include private part safety, safe and unsafe touch, secret safety, you know, early warning signs, intuition, tricky people, you know, helping kids understand what exit strategies are, what different strategies they can learn at different ages to, you know, for exit strategies. So there's a whole, you know, sort of curriculum that you can step into. But even those things that I just laid out, those you don't want to teach overnight. You want to start with the basics that help empower kids, that help them understand about their rights, and then we can start teaching the rest. Yeah. So
baby steps. Yeah. Baby steps. I love that. Oh, I love that. And if you guys perked up and are like, wait, I want to know more about all of those things, well, go over and follow her, guys. Where can people see what you're up to? What's going on? Shameless plug time. Let's hear it.
I'm always on Instagram, probably my favorite place to hang out because I can connect with people directly there. Yeah. So Consent Parenting, and then my website. So consentparenting.com is where you can find tons of resources, and, you know, all the blogs that I write about all this kind of stuff is there too.
Okay. So there you go, guys. Please go check her out. She is such a wonderful resource. And I was so ecstatic and surprised and happy when you like responded to my DM, because you have not a small amount of followers. You have garnered quite the great community there on your Instagram page. And so I was like, oh my gosh, is she even gonna, maybe we'll see. And then you did. And I was so happy because this conversation has been so amazing and wonderful.
Well, I was happy to connect. I really like your content as well. And I love the levity that you bring to it too. I think it's important to not, you know, just be so serious about this issue. There's so much craziness happening in the world all the time, and it can feel overwhelming. So it's really nice to have content, to see content that, you know, like yours is fresh and has a positive, you know, energy to it. Because one of the things, and I wanted to say this earlier, when I did start this process for myself of educating myself, when I was on Instagram, like all I saw were like all of these horrible images of, you know, children and, you know, this really negative, fearful, which I understand because it is,
right,
you know, a terrible thing. But we don't have to present it that way, especially to parents. Like parents already right. have enough that they're freaking out about. Let's present it in a way that makes them want to learn more and want to step into this and feel capable of doing it, because we all are. So
I love that. I
thank
love
you
that.
For doing what you're doing.
Well, you're so welcome. But there you guys go. Please go check her out. And thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you want Save the Kids to come to your community, fill out the speaker form linked in the podcast description below. And make sure to go follow us on Instagram at Save the Kids Inc. for regular updates on how you can raise your resilient kids in this tech-heavy world. Always remember, you are wonderful, you are worthy, and you are worth it. Go home and give your kids an 8-second hug, and we'll see you on the next one.